Committee on Human Services will now come to order. Today is Monday, April the 23rd. And I hope that you had a good restful weekend.
Well, it was good. I don't know about the restful part.
Okay. Well, we had a good weekend anyway. So what I'd like to do is have Mr. Britton go over the outline of our agenda for the week. And immediately after that, just go right into to our bills for the day.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we've handed out a weekly schedule, and you can see that today we're going to continue with our hearing on House Bill 5031, the Department of Human Services budget bill. We're going to be looking this particular week and next week at the seniors and people with disabilities program area. And that will continue all week long. I'd call your attention to the fact that we have scheduled on Thursday, April 26th, public testimony on senior services. Also this week, tomorrow, we'll be giving it another try with Senate Bill 1034, a work session related to nursing assistant certificate fees. So that will be tomorrow. So we need a quorum so we can work that particular bill. Hopefully that will not take very long. Then if you turn the page, you'll see that next week we continue with the seniors and people with disabilities program area. We'll be focusing that week on services for persons with developmental disabilities on Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday we continue, but we have public testimony on services for persons with developmental disabilities. And finally, next Thursday, May 3rd, a wrap-up for the Seniors and People with Disabilities program area. That's what's on tap for this week and for next week.
Questions on the agenda? Thank you, Mr. Britton.
The only thing else to add, Madam Chair, is that James Taves is here. James Taves is the assistant director who heads this particular program area. And he's going to be reviewing a little bit in more detail what is on tap for this week.
Okay. Mr. Taves, can you join us? A little better than last week for you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves, Assistant Director for the Senior and Disability Program of the Department of Human Services. We're very pleased to be here. We've handed out on this long sheet a proposed schedule as well. The programs in the senior disability areas are many, many, many programs that we will not have the time to cover all in great detail. So we wanted to give you an idea of how we propose to sort of break down the programs and the schedule as we go through this week and next week. So we'll attempt at least to try to follow that with your indulgence and go wherever else the committee wants to take us. Senior disability program is going through a lot of changes and challenges at this time, and I'd like to highlight very briefly probably four major themes that we hope to communicate during this week. One is, if you look at, and for this week we're mostly dealing with the aging and physical disability program, next week with the developmental disability program. If you look until about 2003, and we'll look in more detail later at actual caseloads, but caseloads were steadily climbing up until the year 2003, when as a result of the five special sessions and the budget reductions, we significantly reduced eligibility for senior disability programs, made some pretty significant reductions, and have held eligibility at a much lower threshold since that time. And since that time, caseloads have been fairly flat and in some cases actually declining, which seems counterintuitive given the growth of this whole population. On the other hand, we have been doing extensive planning. The governor directed us 3 years ago to begin a comprehensive planning process on the future of long-term care. We know that in Oregon as well as nationally, the aging and disability population is going to more than double. We expect our caseloads within the next 20 years to more than double. So we're really beginning a comprehensive effort to look at what the future of this system should look like, how to make it as sustainable as possible and yet preserving the core values of choice and independence that Oregon has held dear. And we will actually, hopefully by the end of tomorrow, do some modeling for you of some of the planning and how we see that translating potentially into some service descriptions 15 to 20 years out from here. So that's one major theme. Caseloads are fairly stable right now, but it's with suppressed eligibility, and those caseloads will quickly climb in the next couple of years. The other issue that we're wanting to focus on that we addressed to some degree in this particular budget, Oregon has had a very well-balanced long-term care system with one of the most robust home care programs in the entire country, many, many community-based alternatives that's allowed Oregon to serve a relatively small percentage of its population in institutional care or nursing homes. And it's been a fairly careful partnership between private pay and public financing, primarily through the Medicaid program through the years. And that balanced continuum of services has served us very well. That continuum is severely challenged now as different parts of our system have changed with different Medicaid rates, provider taxes, collective bargaining for home care workers. In many ways, the middle of our system, which is foster care, assisted living, residential care facilities, the Medicaid rates and the private pay rates, the disparity is growing very rapidly. And that really means a challenge for us in terms of whether we're going to have adequate places and beds in our service system to keep people out of institutional care. So that's one issue that we want to address with you during this week as well.
Let me ask a question, Mr. Tate. So when you said that we're being challenged by this, and we gave a litany of things that is causing the challenge, how do you foresee then that we can keep up? Because the option would be either in-home care or nursing home care. Isn't the cost in in-home care more moderate than the nursing home care?
Chair Carter, in most cases, yes. And in most cases, in-home care is also less expensive than other forms of 24-hour care, like foster care or assisted living. But we serve some folks with pretty complex needs, some pretty high acuity needs in our community-based system, unlike many other states. And it's that group that's really beginning to challenge us as we attempt to preserve that. And we'll actually present, I think, tomorrow some data in terms of what's happening to the trends in some of our community-based systems as a result of that. The last theme, and we'll pick this up next week in the Developmental Disabilities Program, in the next 2 years we will finish the major Staley Settlement Agreement. This was the lawsuit from early 2001 that required us over initially a 5-year period, then we extended it during the budget reductions of 2003 through 5 to enroll all people with disabilities, developmental disabilities, at least in some level of in-home or community support services, not 24-hour care, but at least to get to a point where everybody that was eligible at least had some service. We will be completing that within the next biennium. We'll be describing that. And then we're really looking at the next set of challenges in our developmental disability service system. And increasingly, the stability of our 24-hour care system, turnover among direct care staff, wages and benefits, which are issues that we address in this budget, we'll be highlighting that as well. So those are some of the themes and challenges that we hope to cover in the next couple of weeks. By way of introduction, very, very briefly, in terms of the history of Oregon, most of you know the history. Oregon continues to lead most of the country in how long-term care services are delivered. There are only five states that actually spend more than half of all their resources in non-institutional care. Oregon leads that group. It's Oregon, New Mexico, Vermont, our sister to the north, Washington, and Alaska, which are the other states that actually spend more than half of all resources on non-institutional care, with Oregon at about 70% when you combine all of our programs. That's pretty historic, and in many states you actually see the reverse, where 60, 70, 80% of all the resources are still spent on institutional care. So Oregon is kind of off the chart historically, and it's much of the policy direction that this legislature has set over many years. Beginning in 1981, some very important landmark bills were passed that set up the first senior services division. In the next session, physical disabilities were added, and it also created a policy direction for developmental disabilities. And all of those policy directions in OOS 427 and 410 are absolutely consistent, directing the state to develop community-based alternatives, home-based alternatives, to eliminate as much as possible the need for institutional care, and to give people as broad a range of choices as possible. When we look at Oregon statutes crafted beginning in the early 80s until now, they still represent, from my perspective, some of the best language in statute anywhere in the country in terms of how we support seniors and people with disabilities. And that's a real credit to the state and to this legislature. As I indicated, well over half of the resources in this program are expended on the community side. If you look on page 5 of your book, at the little pie chart, it's a high-level graph of how the budget of the Senior and Disability Program and the governor's recommended budget is distributed. It's $2.8 billion. Services to clients with developmental disabilities makes up about 36%. For the senior and physical disability, about 47%. And then you see the other program support and other issues that we'll cover in more detail later. On the next page, on page 6, it shows the fund splits. We're very, very heavily leveraged with federal funds. Oregon has taken every opportunity since the early 80s to find ways to match the federal Medicaid Title 19 program. Oregon was the first state in the country to submit a home and community-based waiver to allow Medicaid dollars to be used in non-institutional settings. I think we submitted our first waiver before the print was even dry on the statute and language, and the regulations had not even been written, and Oregon had its application in. So we've been very leveraged with federal funds, Medicaid funds. The other funds in that pie chart on the top of page 6 are primarily client contributions. And then on the bottom, you can see that almost 90%, over 90% of all of the resources in the Senior and Disability Program goes out to our partners and to our providers. We partner with local government to provide and oversee most of these services on the developmental disability side. We work through county developmental disability programs. On the senior and physical disability side, we do most of our work through area agencies on aging, both the Medicaid program and then the other programs, Oregon Project Independence, Older Americans Act. And that's unique, again. It is very, very unique to the state of Oregon. Some of your partners in the area agencies on aging can tell you when they go to other states, this is unlike a model that you will see in most parts of the country. at the top of page 7 is just a snapshot of the numbers of people that we serve, both seniors, physical disabilities, and people with developmental disabilities, including some broad outreach to the public at large through the Older Americans Act, where we serve over 230,000 people that we touch in some way. The biggest portion of the budget, of course, is in the Medicaid long-term care area, the 28,000 that we serve in the Medicaid long-term care portion of the budget. But again, most of the payments all go out directly to providers and to our local partners which administer the program. And the state also, and we'll describe later, we operate a small training center still left in Eastern Oregon in Pendleton, a 40-bed facility for people with developmental disabilities. And then we have state-operated community programs that we operate with state employees for people with developmental disabilities, which were the last and most challenging group that we served after Fairview was closed. On page 10 of the book is just a snapshot of the organizational structure of the Senior and Disability Program. We have four key offices: licensing and quality of care, federal reporting and financial eligibility, developmental disability services, and then the senior and physical disability services. Oregon, again, is unique in how our long-term care program is structured. When you go to most states, you will find that most of these services are carved up and distributed across many different agencies, and many states struggle to actually figure out how they can unite their budgetary controls, their regulatory controls, their program planning, the Medicaid budget in a single place. AARP did a major monograph about a year ago highlighting states that over the years had sort of wisely put all the policy and budget in the same area, and Oregon again was highlighted in that. So it's again a tribute to the leadership of the state historically to really put policy and all of the budget authority in the same place. The other theme that we'll get into a little bit later, and I talked a bit about our local partners and the challenges that our local partners face through the federal Medicaid program, through Medicare modernization, through a whole series of things. We have added enormous amounts of workload onto our system in recent years, which I think our partners in many cases would call unfunded mandates, and I would not disagree with that. The complexity of this work has increased by many, many fold, and it really presents a challenge in how we continue to operate this entire program. So with that, Chair Carter, I thought we'd launch right into our programs, and we're hoping to cover today Oregon Project Independence. The one program that we'd hope to take out of sequence from the book is the Older American Act programs, which based on the budget structure show up much later in the book, but they really fit together with Oregon Project Independence and our other broader public outreach programs that we operate through the Area Agency on Aging. So we'd like to combine those in the first day's presentation. We hope to get to community-based care today as well.
Any questions on the high-level view that Mr. Tavesley just presented? Any questions? Thank you.
So with that, I'd like to call Jeanette Burkett up. She administers our Office of Senior and Physical Disability Programs and is in charge of Oregon Project Independence, the in-home program, and many other things.
All right. Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here. I am going to talk about the Older Americans Act programs first, and they're on page 63 in the book, 63 through 65. And the reason I've really chosen to do that is the Older Americans Act programs, if you think of all of the services for the aging and people with disabilities, if you think of them as representing a continuum, the Older Americans Act programs are probably the least expensive to provide, the least disruptive to anyone's life, and the least intrusive. And they're very much preventive. we receive, they're totally federally funded. It's about $32 million in federal funds. And the programs are all delivered through area agencies on aging throughout the state. They're designed for people age 60 and over and are targeted toward people with the greatest economic and social needs, and also call for a focus on low-income minorities and seniors, in particularly in rural areas. And the programs themselves have a variety, and they're locally developed with local communities. So in some, there's more emphasis on some programs, and some areas emphasize others. They're not totally consistent throughout the state in terms of their emphasis, but all of the programs funded represent a particular range that includes family caregiving support, nutrition programs, which encompass both congregate meal sites and home-delivered meals. Some programs offer particular emphasis on wellness and health prevention, exercise, those kinds of things. There's senior employment programs, legal services, and elder abuse and prevention, as well as other supportive services, just as information and assistance, and ability to assess and help families looking for other resources within a community. In 2006, as James said, over 230 clients in Oregon accessed these services, and they really do represent a huge help to people who sometimes never access anything further in the public arena in terms of just assisting them to remain in their own homes and as independent as possible. If there's, we're not asking for any policy option packages related to the Older Americans Act programs, and there haven't really been any reductions proposed in this budget cycle either, since it is all federal funds. So I'll take questions, I guess, on that program, unless, or otherwise I can move on to the Oregon Project and Independence.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there particularly specific performance measures for the Older Americans Act?
The specific performance, there's not any Oregon performance measures related to those. There are guidelines from the federal government in terms of the focus that I mentioned, in terms of lowest economic and social need, and serving rural Oregonians
Madam Chair, Representative Kotick, there's an extensive data system that's required. It's very detailed that all of our area agencies on aging have to comply with.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that clarification. I guess my interest is, since there are no income or asset requirements, except for that one small portion, can you comment on how well you're doing in terms of reaching low-income minorities or folks at the lower income levels, which is it's the suggested target, but there's nothing technical to the program to make sure that that's who you restrict your services to.
Yes, Representative Kotick, we do have data that does demonstrate how well we are doing at that, and I believe some of that data is going to be presented tomorrow.
Excuse me, what particular section? Is that just part of your recipients discussion?
Yes, it would be.
Thank you.
The other point to be made, Madam Chair and members, about the Older American Act program, and I think to the frustration of many states, this program has mostly been flatly funded through multiple budget cycles at the federal level, notwithstanding that the whole aging population is growing very rapidly. And it seems to be one of those titles that just comes in at about the same appropriation level year after year. So that's certainly been a concern, and actually there's been some small reductions because inflationary increases have not been included in that.
Well, and I was talking to Senator Westland, and I might be repeating your question, but it sounds like I might be. But my concern was just with the federal government cutting other things out, I just wondered what the likelihood would they would be cutting this down, or would they be, in light of what you just said, talking about increasing them, since there'll be more and more people like me who in 4 years I'll be there.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, the Older Americans Act was recently reauthorized, and I don't think any of us are optimistic that, at least at any time in the near future, that they will invest significant new resources in this program. I think that's a concern to everyone, given the whole demographic issue. There was extensive discussion about this at the White House Conference on Aging, but again, it just hasn't seemed to have gotten much traction at this point in time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. The distribution formula, it says, is based on demographics and square mileage of each area. I don't imagine that the square mileage is going to change at all. But is the demographic piece of it, is the formula reassessed every time there's an appropriation? That's the first question I had. And then if that's true, what direction are we going in with it? And the second one is, what is the maintenance of effort discussion around this?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, the maintenance of effort is sort of a curious artifact, and we've always maintained that the Oregon Project Independence was, in fact, the maintenance of effort, and based on some old formula, which I could certainly dig out, I don't recall at the top of my head, it's about $3 or $4 million of OPI that we reference as the maintenance of effort requirement for the Older American Act program. The formula, let me add, is a fairly complex formula based on both demographics and miles. I believe we have a work group that's now meeting to thoroughly look at that formula to see if it needs to be updated, whether we have a fair distribution between urban and rural areas, and I think we're going to do that within the next year. But it is a fairly complex formula.
Madam Chair, getting back just for a moment to the maintenance of effort issue, because what I thought I heard you say was that this is basically a flat-funded program, is there issues under increasing the state's investment, or is a stable investment a satisfactory match?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I think you will see when we get into a bit of our long-range planning that we actually believe over time that our program's funding kind of seniors at large, not just people that are low-income and in the Medicaid program, needs to be vastly expanded over time to keep people independent and safe as long as possible without the need for formal supports later on. And that includes many components within the Older American Act program. And we actually have some modeling that we've done to show how we might do that over time. So I would actually see the types of programs we provide in the Older American Act program as expanding over time, not shrinking. If you go back to the enabling statute that created the Senior Services Division, much of it directs us to provide lots of support to aging and disability communities quite outside of the formal service system with counseling, care options, financial planning and advice, caregiver support. I mean, all of those things that sort of help keep individuals and families intact. And over the years, in many ways, we've shrunk down to kind of a long-term care system focused much more exclusively on Medicaid. And I think, given the demographic, we need to go the opposite direction and to say, how do we provide support to individuals and communities in a broad way that keeps people independent as long as possible and not focus so much just on those people actually within our caregiving system. So I'm optimistic over time that we'll move in that direction. But at this point, in terms of either state or federal funds, there's not much expansion in this program.
Thank you. Senator Winters?
And Senator Morissette. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just an observation in talking about the Early Americans Act and the federal funding and the fact that it's flat-funded, I think the challenge before us is that we're going to see more and more of the federal dollars diminishing. And I think for us as policymakers that, you know, we need to be looking at as James, Mr. James said, of what kind of a system that we want to support. And remember, we can't totally always depend upon the federal government. And I think that truly is our challenge. I think we relied so heavily on programs and what we're getting from the feds that we've forgotten about, you know, I think the good planning for Oregon and what we actually started here. And I think those are the challenges for us to step up and then look at where those gaps are and where we may have to fill those gaps.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Madam Chair, we're going to move into Oregon Budget Independence.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Senator Morissette.
My apologies.
Could you, for the record, tell me why or what is involved in the 90% of equity? What is the other 10%? Why are we only doing 90% of what we are paying state workers? Could you explain that discrepancy?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, absolutely. And we'll also talk about this because we do have a policy option package here as well. Historically, when area agencies on aging have elected, which is under Chapter 410, local government, in effect, has the right of first refusal. They can choose to operate the Medicaid program in what's known as a Type B triple area agency on aging, which operates all the Older Americans Act, Oregon Project Independence, and the Medicaid program as well. At each point in time when that decision was made by a local government, the state then transferred state employees, facilities, resources, and all of those things. What's happened, and it's not only true in the aging area, but in our DD area and other areas as well, is we then treat local government like contractors. So year by year, they get whatever cost of living adjustment we pass on to our contractors. What we haven't done historically is then go back and update what the costs would have been on the state side if you had an identical state office providing those services, what the cost to those state employees, their equipment, their computers, their facilities, and all of those things. So what's happened over time at the local government level is the level of support has kept eroding. They might have been flush with what the state otherwise would have spent on the program at the time of the actual transfer, but then it keeps eroding because the cost of living adjustment would not keep pace. Legislation was passed 4 years ago, I believe it was, or could, I believe it was 4 years ago, that required us to develop a formula in which we would take an identical state office, map out all the costs, the employee costs, the indirect, the equipment and all that, and then square that with 95% as what the allocation should be that we propose in our budget for the governor's consideration to finally get to 95% of equity, which is what's involved in that particular statute. Where the AAAs, the five transfer AAAs rank right now is actually lower than 90%. They're anywhere between 82 to 89%. In the governor's proposed budget, we propose to bring that up to 95% and square it with that statutory formula.
Okay, follow up, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Do you have a performance measure on achieving the 95%? Is that a goal? Do you ever plan to achieve 95% of equity with these five area local government?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, absolutely. We intend to achieve it this year. I mean, it is our budget recommendation that we get to 95% in this budget cycle. And our goal after that time, once we're at 95%, is in the future we calculate the costs using that formula that updates the state side of the costs, crosswalks it to the AAAs, and again squares it at 95% in all subsequent biennia, so we don't have this gap that then occurs over time.
One more question, please.
why are we looking at 95% instead of 100% and across the board equity with the state employees and the contract employees? I don't understand why we're not dealing with 100% instead of 95%.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, my goal is to get to 95% first, because that's what the statutory requirement is, and I think that's what we need to do to be fair. And I think after that, we can look at going from 95 to 100%. I think there were feelings at the time when the law was passed that local agencies might be more efficient than state operations. I can't speculate on all the reasons, but that actually is what the formula is by statute.
I might take a new statute. Thank you. Thank you.
Madam Chair, let's move into Oregon Project Independence. Jeanette?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Oregon Project Independence.
What page are we going back to?
Oh, we're back on page 13. Oregon Project Independence is a state-funded program that represents long-term care services for Oregonians who are not receiving Medicaid long-term care services. And historically, it's a program that has served Oregonians 60 years in age and over, although in 2005, the legislature approved expanding the program to younger adults with disabilities. And we're presently in the process of implementing that expansion and have a work group that is still working on rules development, and we do hope to have the expanded program come online this fall. The services under the Oregon Project Independence are caregiver assistance, homemakers, chore services, assisted transportation. There's a range of services that also includes adult day services, respite care, some registered nurse assessment and consultation, home delivered meals, and case management. And the program is delivered throughout the state, also through our area agencies on aging, and serves approximately 3,400 clients monthly. And it's a program that we believe really, in many cases, represents the only access people need to make to a government-funded program to allow them to remain in their own homes, sometimes throughout their lives. And it's definitely proven to be a deterrent to people having to access more invasive and expensive services through the Medicaid long-term care program.
Questions? Can I just ask, and I know you probably didn't come prepared, but if you don't qualify because of a higher income, that you can pay for the services, how much do they cost?
The program, the Oregon Project Independence, requires that people with net incomes between 100 and 200% of the federal poverty level need to contribute toward their services. And because the services range from very little to, because the funding is so limited, in most instances, it's not many hours of service. I would guess that the range is from nothing to maybe $300 or $400 a month.
Okay.
I would say at the high end.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is if money's not an issue, can they still receive the services and pay for them? I'm sorry, I wasn't clear.
I'm sorry.
And because there's all kinds of services available to people on the private market, but if they wanted to, because you have such a good reputation with OPI, they could call and receive them.
Yes, Representative Boone, Chair Carter, and members of the committee, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question, but certainly people could pay the full cost of their services if they had income that allowed them to do that. And you're right, people do feel good about the service because they also receive, in addition to the actual service provision itself, they receive an assessment and an ongoing work of a case manager that helps them really through the system and help them recognize when there are additional needs and additional resources that they might access.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now I'm feeling a little confused. Do you have more that you're going to be presenting on this topic, or was that it? I should, whatever questions I'm going to have, this is my one chance.
Representative Nathan sending them. Chair, this is probably your chance.
Okay. With the response to the previous question, I think it's wonderful that there is a good resource that people can rely on for providing straight information, good referrals, and know that whatever is suggested to them in the way of options is accurate and reliable information. But you were answering in response to Representative Boone's questions that if someone would not qualify for a subsidy, basically, if you don't qualify for a subsidy, you could still purchase the service at cost. But you mentioned the other parts of the service, such as case management and so forth, that accompanies it. Are you also reimbursing for the cost of that, or only for the service itself that you purchased?
Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, the fee that would be assessed and the full cost would be for the service itself. It would not include case management costs. Recipients of the services are always able to make donations to the program in general if they wish to contribute more than the full cost. So I would have to say that doesn't happen often, but it would be an option.
Brief follow-up?
Sure.
So do we have information available to us on how many people are taking advantage of the option to use OPI to purchase services at cost? And what I'm getting at is, how large of a program does the state need to manage for a number of persons served, and what percentage of those are paying full cost for the service, but it's the general fund or some other fund that's paying for the case management part?
Mm-hmm. Representative Nathanson and members of the committee, I don't have the numbers with me, but I know we can get those for you. And in general, I can say that very, very few people really pay the full cost. For the most part, these are low-income Oregonians utilizing the service, and the bulk of them receive the services because of their income at no cost. There's a range in between, but it's very, very small at the high end.
But Madam Chair, Representative, the area agencies on aging do collect fees from this program. We've always collected that fee information, and we can certainly supply that to you as well.
Thank you very much. Senator Bortley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had this discussion in the past, so my question will relate to whether or not the there's uniform standards for the AAAs based on the service provided, what the sliding scale is for that service based on income, and do you have that kind of information there that you can get for this committee?
Yes, we do.
And also revenue generated from the AAAs based on those same factors.
Yes, Senator Winters, we do, and we can supply that for the committee.
Because that would be very helpful for members, one, that we do have uniform standards where the AAAs have a particular kind of service and what that service costs and what the sliding scale actually is, because I know that several years ago that this was a big issue, and mm-hmm. and a lot of work has probably been done since then.
We can get that.
And I'm going to move on then if there are no more questions.
I have a question for you.
And then Representative Kotak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the OPI expansion to younger people with disabilities, and you have indicated that this expanded program will come online in the fall. What numbers are projected to receive services? And also, the anticipated expansion, is that captured in the co-chair's budget? And then thirdly, how's that planning and expansion for the expansion, how's that going? What are the what challenges are you experiencing in bringing on a brand new program?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordy, if I could answer your first question in terms of the budget levels. The governor's recommended budget recommended $16 million, primarily from the senior tax property deferral account, which is $4 million above what the amount was for the 05-07 biennium. I think the co-chairs level that at $12 million, so that's the relative difference between the two.
And within that, if I may ask, within the co-chair's number, were they factoring in the expansion to the youth, to the young people with disabilities?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordy, I can't answer that. We had a very long debate, and a few of you will remember this from last session, when the legislation included the addition of people with disabilities, and there was actually language in the proposed, not in the proposed, but the legislation that passed last session, that we should add people with disabilities when adequate resources were in the fund to do so. Now, no one really defined what adequate resources were, and the debate that we've had is there a level playing field? The next day we open it to people with disabilities, is it first come, first served? If a senior walks in or a person with a disability walks in, do we serve them simply in priority order? Or is there an amount allocated for seniors versus people with disabilities? And I think eventually we want to get to where anybody who's eligible, whether it's by age or by disability, that this basically would be an age-neutral program. But what that magic number is, I don't know. I mean, we would propose, and the work group has been working very hard on the eligibility and the services that will be available once we start it for people with disabilities. We have within the governor's budget, at least we could expand it by $4 million. That's what's available in the fund.
Mr. Britton?
Yes.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, the governor's budget funded OPI at $16.6 million. The co-chairs is at $12.6 million. And the 12.6 was based on standard inflation. So my belief is that it does not include any expansion to younger persons with physical disabilities. As you know, the co-chairs had concerns about the sustainability of this funding source.
And so, to follow up, Madam Chair,
sure.
The agency then is planning for a legislatively approved expansion of OPI to younger people, legislatively approved in 2005. But there's no funding. Apparently, there's no funding to implement that plan. So that's one of the challenges. What other challenges are you experiencing as you look at rolling out services for younger people?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley and members of the committee, you asked an excellent question as to what that population of clients will look like, and that is our biggest struggle as we try to roll out and implement the program, is we really don't have a good sense of what the needs or what the desires in terms of service provision are going to be from that population. We know that because of the program itself that they will need to meet the functional needs that we assess for others, and we're very familiar with younger people with disabilities that we serve in the Medicaid program now, but we're not quite sure who we're going to get in that younger population that this program is going to be appeal to. So we are struggling to sort of figure out who that population might be and what their needs are, and try to develop the program and the rules in as flexible a way as we can in order to anticipate serving them.
Another follow-up,
sure.
Madam Chair. Yes. if we continue in a way that where the co-chair's budget fails to provide funding for younger people with disabilities, and that's a legislatively adopted mandate, then do we, are we open to any kind of legal challenge?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I really can't answer that question. Again, the issue for us is the statute clearly directed us to expand it to people with disabilities, and it sort of left it that adequate resources should be available without really defining what that is. And so when we looked at the program moving from 12 to 16 million, we felt we needed to begin to expand that population. And I think the important issue for us is in every other way we determine eligibility across the board based on your needs for daily assistance. So in many ways our entire Medicaid program and other parts of the long-term care program are age neutral. So we think that should apply to people with disabilities as well. We should think of them differently because essentially it's their functional needs which determine the service level. And I think the other thing we know is that many times people with disabilities are poor and often are, if they have those service priority levels, will already be in our Medicaid program. So I don't think you'll see a huge number of people with disabilities with those level of needs that would necessarily come into OPI because I think given their incomes, they would probably need the Medicaid service to begin with and they would probably need the health care insurance that goes with that. So our proposed expansion was around the governor's proposed budget, and I'm not sure what else to say about that. I don't know about any legal challenges.
Last question.
Sure.
I would like someone to look at that piece, Madam Chair, and come back with a more definitive answer about whether we would be open to a legal challenge.
Mr. Britton's taking up with that.
Thank you.
I don't think we were apprised of the Staley nor the Harmon or any of those. I think people use the initiative, but we would have Mr. Britton to check it out in terms of the legality of whether we followed the rules of engagement or not.
Further question? Representative Kochet?
Two questions, Madam Chair, on this topic. Did the co-chairs give us any direction of where they want the 12.6? That was just for the existing program without the expansion. I'm sorry, I'm asking for a follow-up.
Right.
I have to say, I have concerns. It doesn't sound like we know if we had that money what we'd be exactly doing with it. And I hope that doesn't sound too harsh, but when you talk about expanding people with disabilities, I'm not getting the impression that there's a plan yet for that money. Am I missing something?
Madam Chair, Representative Cote, we would propose to expand the program just the way the Oregon Project Independence Program works now. So we would expand the eligibility. We would then avail the same types of services. And again, for the most part, it's in-home services or chore services, usually a limited number of hours. And if you think about $12 million serving about 3,500 people at any given time, the expansion would be that percentage of expansion of people who could potentially avail themselves of the program. OPI has never been an entitlement. There's always been waiting lists historically. And in fact, the program suffered through some of the lean budget years and we reduced people and started waiting lists all over again. So the area agencies on aging, essentially, they operate within a contained budget since it's not an entitlement. And they serve everybody for whom they have money for until the money runs out. So when we open it, it'll be people who meet those eligibility criteria present themselves at our doors, for which at the local area, based on their allocation, that's how much they'll have to serve those individuals until the money runs out.
So would your intent to serve through the AAAs for this population?
Madam Chair, Representative Cote, absolutely. I mean, this whole program is run as a key area on agency program. The one issue we're discussing is we have some area agencies on aging that don't operate the Medicaid program and historically have just done the Older Americans Act and OPI for seniors. That's primarily in the rural areas and in some areas along the coast. So this would be a new population for them, and we've had extensive discussions with them. But I think, yes, we would intend to operate this program through our local partners as we always have.
Thank you. Well, different question?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for providing information in Appendix B on OPI. But I have a question. Is this point in time data for 1998? Is that, am I reading this correctly? And if that is the case, do we have a more recent snapshot out of your data system? Because this isn't your entire population. This is a random sample from your files. I'm just wondering if you have a more up-to-date version of that.
Representative Kotek and members of the committee, I believe that this was from 2008, or from 1998, and I believed that in 2006, but I'm going to have to make sure of that, so don't hold me to it, but I will double check on that. I believed we did an additional data pull that still supported essentially the information from the first study in terms of proportions. But I will.
We can pull that.
Yeah, I will double check on that.
Thank you. I mean, that's 8 years. There could be some differences
right
there. Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you, Ms.
Madam. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope this is a very quick one. On page 21, where we see performance measures, I noticed that the target has been set pretty much now at 98.5%. The actual has varied just a small degree for several years in a row. And I wanted to ask, is there any statistical significance to these changes? 98.3, then up to 98.5, then back down to 98.3. Are there specific causes, or are these numbers so close that it means it's virtually the same? Is there something we should get out of this?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, I don't believe that it's a margin of difference that's significant. I mean, I'll check with our data people, but again, this is relative to the entire population of seniors. So as the overall population shifts slightly, it would probably cause that, but I can double check that.
Thank you.
Virginia University is just those persons that are within the framework of the eligibility for which you serve?
Madam Chair, that particular performance measure is all Oregonians who are seniors.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a little curious to me to switch back and forth mentally in this chapter, looking at statistics for Oregon Project Independence, but then seeing some other numbers in other subsections that are for that relate to all Oregonians, the 28,000 Oregonians using long-term services, and then trying to figure out how the performance measure relates to OPI specifically. I was just needing a little help with that.
Mr. Tins, how relevant is this measure? Do you think? When you think of the population you serve, and then looking at the universe just being all Oregonians in a certain age category.
Madam Chair, truthfully, I don't think it's terribly relevant anymore because Oregon sort of set the stage for how we operate services and the fact that we serve most people in their own homes or in the community a long time ago. So unless something really changes where that whole continuum of care gets out of whack or out of balance, I don't think you'd see any minor variations in this. And that is, I mean, the caseloads, and we'll go through the caseloads tomorrow. We track those very rigorously in terms of how many are in institutions in their own homes and served in alternate community settings. That's really the measure that we use as a management tool on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis. This is a very high-level summary, and again, I would not expect to change significantly unless the whole system got off kilter.
Thank you.
Senator Winter? Question. As we look to the future, is somewhere in your statistical information, are you going to do a projection of what the senior population will look like, given the baby boomers and its impact that's coming rapidly? And how that fits in with talking about Oregon Project Independence and the institutional system, living facilities, so that we can begin to get a sense of what the future holds.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, tomorrow, unless we get to it today, we're going to talk at length about the data we've collected and projections about the population, what we expect the increases in each of the age cohorts between 65, 74, 75, and 84, and 85 and above will be, what impact we think that will have on our caseloads. We have a series of graphs and charts here. We are going to provide you with an addendum, which is our latest draft of the long-range plan, which has additional data. We're going to present to you what we've done on a county-by-county basis to drill down and look exactly at where we think the demographic is going in each local area of the state. And then we have done some modeling in terms of what we would do with Oregon's long-term care system if you took it exactly as it is today and simply trended it forward 20 years. And just add up the cost and the same percentage of people and the same service types. So we've done that display, and then we've done a display that would actually show an altered model of services that would provide a lot more services for people at the front end, almost an OPI-like service. With a restructured waiver, and there's some new federal options that we're going to discuss with you in the next several days that the federal government has made available to the states, which Oregon is researching whether that would fit into Oregon's long-term care system. So absolutely, we are very much in that planning mode and intend to share that information with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Kochak.
Thank you. Just one brief question. Do you track your numbers by placement setting with acuity levels at all? Who are in the facilities? At what level of care do they need? Can you provide some of that information?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I'll point you right in our book to page 19.
Madam Chair. I see your numbers there, but I'm looking for a little bit more than that. I'm looking for actual, the acuity level in the different facilities. And what I'm seeing is who's in what facility, but that doesn't really, I'm looking for a little bit more than that.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, and I was planning to go through this tomorrow, but I can talk about it very briefly. These are the acuity levels. If you look at the left hand of the graph, it's service priority levels 1 through 13, with 1 being total care, 13 being the least level of impairment, based on a fairly detailed electronic assessment tool that we use to assess all individuals in long-term care. And then we've distributed those acuity levels, and it used to be 1 through 18. Oregon originally served 1 through 18 in our home and community-based waiver. Levels 14 through 17 were then cut in the 2003-2005 period. So now we serve service priority levels 1 through 13. So these are the ones distributed across the different service settings, and we can even drill it down farther than that by each specific facility type.
Madam Chair, thank you for the clarification. I guess I'm looking for the entire population, not just the Medicaid population, so OPI, general population, because as we look at demographics, this is who we know in the Medicaid population over there, and I understand that. Thank you very much for clarifying that. I'm trying to get a sense of what is our acuity level on OPI, older America. I mean, across the whole system, not just the Medicaid. eligible ones.
Madam Chair, Representative Conte, I believe we can do it for OPI. We don't do that for the broader Older Americans Act. We don't actually do that level of assessment. We do that assessment for people in Oregon Project Independence, however.
Okay, thank you.
So we can supply that information, certainly.
Senator Gordon?
Madam Chair, I'm going back to the issue of younger people, serving younger people with disabilities, and I'm going to ask for some follow-up from Mr. Britton, working together with the agency, just to help clarify my reading of what's in statute. I'm looking at ORS 410-435. And in subsection 2, it says the department may not adopt the rules expanding Oregon Project Independence described in this subsection 1 of this section unless the amount of monies in the Oregon Project Independence Fund established in ORS 410-422 is sufficient to provide services to eligible clients, and then goes on to give another site. So do you see where I still have a concern about capacity and what it is we're really preparing to do if the funds aren't going to be sufficient to do it, and if you have language here that says you can't expand if the monies are insufficient?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, again, I recall some lengthy discussions with the authors of this bill last session, and you know, it wasn't clear what that would really mean. And again, during that discussion, we said whether the OPI fund source is expanded or doubled or whatever, it is still a finite fund source, so it will serve as many people as we have funding that we can allocate out to our area agencies on aging. So the discussion then was, well, if it goes from 12 to 16, is it $12 million for seniors, which are the group that historically have been served under this program? Because by law, the first priority in this program are people already receiving services, so we couldn't expand it to people with disabilities, turn around, and then kick seniors off. By law, clearly, those getting the service have a right to stay on that service for as long as they need it, as the funds are available. So that's the push-pull on this. We believe we have an obligation to people with disabilities to serve them as best we can within those resources, and so we were going to increase it. But again, what adequate really means, I don't know, because it's not an entitlement program. It's still a finite fund source.
Yeah, the word here is sufficient. And, Madam Chair, I'm just coming back to it because I'm just real uncomfortable with where we are. There's an expectation out there on the part of a certain constituency that services are going to be made available. But the testimony is something other than definitive about all of that, and I'm just very troubled.
Madam Chair,
Representative Marceau.
Well, that was my bill last time, and there was pushback from a few seniors, and the pushback resulted in putting the funding when available, which effectively shut the door. That was done on purpose. We don't want to fund more people until we have more funding, and so we'll put that in. So, yeah, that's a roadblock for funding. My feeling is Project Independence, it means people who need assistance being independent, which should apply equally to the disabled. And my intent was to include the disabled along with the elderly. But that language was put in there to prevent that from happening. Now, it may never happen because of that language, because there may never be enough money available. So that's what we have to live with unless we change the statute.
Thank you. Mr. Tate?
Madam Chair, could we move on to the enroll program? Enroll, get the data and information requested on OPI.
Sure.
Chair Carter, members of the committee. I'm now on page 14, and I'm going to talk about in-home services as part of our Medicaid long-term care service programs. In-home services are essentially for Medicaid, for clients that are on Medicaid and are seniors or people with disabilities and are living in their own homes, but that ability to live independently has been compromised by increasing functional limitations. So since 1981, when the old Senior Services Division began and we started serving people under the home and community-based waiver that Medicaid allows us to do, we have been able to serve a huge proportion of our clientele in their own homes, which is most generally people's first preference. We have a number of different options for those clients that do qualify for in-home services, and those options include the utilization of home care workers, and that's where a client is able to, either the client themselves or a family member or someone close to them who's acting as their surrogate is able to recruit and select and direct the activities of a care provider after one of our case managers has determined their eligibility and done an assessment of their functional needs and essentially authorized the services to be provided. And in that instance, SPD, in addition to case managing and assessment and authorization of services, also makes the payment to the home care worker on behalf of the client. Clients can also choose to be served by in-home care agencies, and in that instance, we contract with in-home agencies that are licensed by the state to provide that home care worker. The same process takes place in terms of the case manager doing a functional assessment and developing a care plan and authorizing the hours, but this provision of service through an agency has advantages to people who are either unable or don't choose to recruit and hire and direct and then have to deal with termination if it comes to that of a home care worker. So it provides another option for those clients.
Can you provide us with last session we heard some testimony with respect to some abuse occurring in the home health care system, particularly where you had individuals who were providing services and suddenly had injuries and things of their own and was putting an awful lot of pressure on the workers' comp system. Have you continued to track that, and have we seen a decline in that particular issue, and have this home abuse area been monitored sufficiently enough that this is no longer a problem?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, members of the committee, we have continued to track the workers' comp utilization by home care workers, and we have seen a decrease in utilization of workers' comp and injuries involved in the home care workers' service provision.
Could you provide this panel with the actual trends?
Yes.
For that?
Yes, Senator Winters. I'd be happy to do that.
And Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we, in the last 2 years with the Home Care Commission, have invested very heavily in training for home care workers as part of collective bargaining in the last collective bargaining round, designated for training. And so literally thousands of home care workers have been trained as part of this process, and I think that's beginning to reap benefits in controlling workers' compensation costs as well.
If I recall some of the discussion last session, the major abuser was around families, where you had a relative that, you know, took care of the relative, and then they ended up being a part of the system. And so I am interested in the trend lines to assure that we've been able to weed that out and to provide the services that is necessary while at the same time making certain that the system isn't being abused.
In addition to the home care agencies, some other service models available to people that are eligible for in-home services are Independent Choices Program, and that's a pilot project that we were able to institute in three areas of the state, in Rogue Valley, Clackamas, and the Coos Kerry counties. And that allows clients who really even desire a higher level of independence and self-determination and self-direction to be able to receive an allotment of what they otherwise, the cash amount of in-home services that they otherwise would have been, we would have paid on their behalf for the service. They're able to receive the money directly and then develop their own care plan in terms of what they buy and when they buy it and when they choose to have services, and allows them a greater flexibility than our traditional program in that they can use some of that funding to buy equipment, adaptive equipment, and some other things that increase their independence but aren't necessarily a paid Medicaid service that we would otherwise be able to pay for. And the program is in its five-year demonstration just ended at the end of last year, and we now an extension of that pilot to be able to basically close out the project and try to move those clients to keep the program, but move it into another waiver program option that the federal government, we hope, is going to be able to make available later this spring to summer.
Sure. Representative Morgan?
This was kind of tweaked my interest when I was reading through it in the binder, and I'm wondering if you have any data that shows how successful this has been in terms of accountability, you know, whether the money was applied to areas that it was anticipated that it would be applied to, and the satisfaction of the people that were involved in the program.
Yes, Representative Morgan, Senator Chair, and members of the committee. Senator Carter, sorry. We do. We have a closing report to the federal government, which includes a great deal of that information, as well as client satisfaction surveys, and does show how the money was utilized and what their acuity levels were at the beginning and how they've been able to maintain that, and I'd be happy to provide that.
Is it available on your website at all?
I'm not sure if it's on the web. I don't... It was at a point in time, but I'm not sure that it's there now. But
and I hesitate to have you bring us in another wheelbarrow load of paper. So if perhaps there is an executive summary that's available online,
yes,
or something,
a couple
that would
of pages
be...
at least, if it's not online, that I can bring those and not need the wheelbarrow.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, on this particular program, Independent Choices, we started as a special waiver from the federal government, and we did some similar cash and counseling programs around the country. The Deficit Reduction Act passed by Congress at the end of last session allows for a statewide rollout of Independent Choices. It's called a new 1915J waiver, I believe it is. And they basically said, you know, we're going to have to close out our current project and then move to that. But the regulations aren't out. There's lots of mixed messages on what that's going to look like. So we're in this kind of weird in-between period, not quite sure whether we can fit it into the new federal format or not. But I think many states are optimistic that for those individuals who truly want to completely manage their own lives, are able to do so, are accountable, can maintain the bank accounts and the payments and whatever that goes with that, that it's a good option. But it's a little bit in a no person's land right now, awaiting federal regulations.
Okay. Chair Carter, members of the committee, I'll go on then. And some of the other programs available in our in-home service program are adult day services, which provide services to clients for less than 24 hours outside of their home or their family member's home. And they essentially go to a center where there's meals provided, activities, and some, in some instances, some health care provided to them. Home-delivered meals is an in-home service program that can be authorized, and for that program, the client has to be able to not access a congregate meal site, has to be homebound, and we do provide that service through the Area Agencies on Aging Home-Delivered Meals Program. And then there is also personal care services, and those services are available to people who are Medicaid eligible, but not they don't have to necessarily be eligible for long-term care services. And that provides basically personal health assistance that is limited to no more than 20 hours per month. And I can entertain questions.
Questions on this one? I just have an observation, and I just wondered how we came up with 20 hours a month on personal care, because I was thinking about if someone needed help with care or bathing or some of those issues, that 20 hours a month. What kind of assessment have you done to determine that 20 hours a month is sufficient or adequate?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, the 20 hours is a personal care option which is available to SSI-eligible recipients, and in many cases they will not be people otherwise receiving other kinds of Medicaid services, but they're eligible at least to that. If they have expanded needs for in-home hours, they would probably go on to the full Medicaid program and utilize the in-home program, in which case, in some cases, we provide two or more shifts a day of in-home care if you have really extensive needs and want to stay in your own home. So it's not limited to 20 hours. This is that particular Medicaid state plan option, and that 20-hour limit has been around for as long as I can remember, and that's been a long time. So the other thing, Madam Chair, I wanted to mention about the in-home program, because again, if you look at the pie chart on page 14, this again is unlike virtually any other state where well over a third of everyone we support in long-term care is supported in their own homes. It's a remarkable statistic. In Oregon, what started out with what was called the CEP program, the Client Employed Provider Program, where clients could actually hire their own staff and in many cases their own relatives. And I haven't looked at the data recently, but I think it's still 30-40% of the home care workers are hired within the family circle or friendship circle of some sort. That's a pretty amazing statistic. And through the collective bargaining, ballot measure 99 that was passed some years ago, home care workers now get some health benefits. They get workers' comp coverage, and they get more per hour. So it's really sort of professionalized that whole work group. But we are struggling with it. And I think Senator Winters asked a question earlier about how we really assure health and safety. And we are now, we're actually pulling a work group together with SEIU, ourselves, some of our other stakeholders, to re-examine that employer-employee relationship to make sure that the client, A, knows that they're making a hiring decision, truly they're hiring and firing, and B, they're able to direct their own work or direct the work of the home care worker, or they have a family member available to do that. That's both for the safety of the client and the home care worker, and it's also a protection for the state, because in as much as we may have case managers who make the hiring decision on behalf of someone who doesn't really understand it, and in as much as we might have case managers who actually start directing that work, any, you know, referee or judge or others are going to look at that and say, that's not an employer-employee relationship. In this case, it's the state or the area agency on aging that's the employer. And that would open up a whole set of other issues. So we're really kind of working with all our partners here to make sure that clients in this program really can make the hiring decision or have family members that can help them make that or get training. The Home Care Commission is also working on training that will help support people in that employer-type role. So I think we want to better professionalize this whole service and keep it intact, because it provides enormous benefits for Oregonians.
Senator, what's your name?
Good, Senator
Winter.
Just a follow-up question, because we have in the long-term care system, particularly in the nursing home and other systems, we have the long-term care ombudsman as a part of a check and balance to make certain where there's safety and abuse issues. Are they involved with this system as well, or do you foresee them being involved with this system?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, they have not been involved, particularly in home care programs, I do not believe. Mostly they work in our nursing homes and our facilities. So we really haven't expanded their role into the home care program at this point in time. In the last couple of visits from our federal partners, the Centers on Medicaid and Medicare, and again, a state with this many people in home care as part of Medicaid is strange for them as well. They just don't see that in most places. And we've had lots of sort of discussions with them on what are our obligations for health and safety for someone served in their own home, when, in fact, some of our clients make choices that some of us probably wouldn't consider to be terribly safe. So there really is an issue there about how far we impinge on choice in an environment that may not be as safe as we would want it to be, and where that fine line is. And I think we're still struggling with that. We've had examples of cases pulled out, and in some cases some really bad abuse because no one was monitoring. So I think we're looking at risks, and as part of our work group sort of reexamining the employer-employee relationship, we want to make sure that if that client isn't truly sort of cognizant of their role in directing care and they need more case management help or help from an in-home agency, that we make that referral. We don't simply sit back and say, well, it was their choice and unfortunate things happened and that's too bad. So it is a program that sort of begs that question of where the choice versus risk line really falls.
Is there a place now, because we're still talking about vulnerable populations, is there a place now for the individual to call if they have a complaint or concern?
Yes, Senator Winters, Chair Carter, and members of the committee. The case manager, I mean, definitely is still there for the person. And they are certainly a first resource if they don't have other family members or someone else that they would turn to more naturally. And they certainly also can call in, I mean, as a protective service. In reality, most of them do talk to their case manager first if issues are coming up or they're not satisfied with their home care worker and they're having struggles to either communicate with them or to remediate the situation themselves in terms of directing their performance. That is usually the first resource. But as James said, unfortunately, there are sometimes clients who are able to take on that role in the beginning and, short of a case manager contact on a regular basis, may have declined to the point that they're not able to do that themselves, and unfortunately there may not be someone that notices what is going on and it does place that person in a vulnerable situation.
We'll have our last question. Senator Westman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to James's comments with regard to Oregon's in-home healthcare system, then maybe make kind of a general budget comment and then hone this down to specifically the CEP program. The first is obviously, James, and this is not due to anyone sitting on this dais. I mean, this happened long before, you know, we were here. Well, maybe Senator Carter. I take that all back. You can slap my hand.
Yeah. It must be a compliment coming up, folks.
Yeah. Which means I'm a lot younger than she is. Oregon is one of the most innovative leaders in this field in the nation, I'd argue the most innovative. And the point is that we've not only saved a tremendous amount of money, we have provided, you know, more compassionate and, I would say, care with a higher efficacy. Having said that, and now I'm speaking mostly to committee members, you know, as I do my burn the midnight oil and
do my back of the envelope numbers, I'm roughly calculating that we're about $110, $112 million short in this budget. And that doesn't include any significant additional expenditures for community-based mental health services. Now, having said that, every major budget category, I don't care if it's public safety, K-12, higher ed, community colleges, everyone can make the argument that, you know, it's not adequately or funded to the level they would like. But as it relates specifically to the CEP program, you know, both the co-chairs and the governor are on the same page on this one, and I would venture to say the wrong page, because they're about $6 million short in completely funding this budget. And what happens, committee members, this is just the way it is, and I don't know if contract negotiations are underway now or about to begin, but what happens is these shortfalls are taken out of employer wages or benefits. And these wages, you know, are $9.75-76. So if you start cutting back salaries or benefits at that juncture, you have what is one of the most costly things that we can do in this system, and that creates, you know, rapid turnover in these fields. Both in the private DD homes and in the in-home health care, we have an incredibly high rapid turnover of, quote, employees. So, James, I want to work with you. I want this committee to work all together to help figure out how we can most certainly present the most rational budget we can, but pay this specific attention, since this is the focus today, on how we can bring the CEP program up to reasonable and rational funding. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments today, and we will see you tomorrow.
Great.
Committee dismissed.